you up in a second.
All right, well, obviously, I'll be discussing applications of the theory of the tragedy of the commons to agricultural systems. Can you guys hear me now? Was it a problem before? Okay.
It records the
session. Oh, thank you. Okay. All right. So, for those of you not familiar with the tragedy of the commons theory, okay, this is an idea that Harding came up with in the 60s, and basically he was concerned about human behavior. And so he was trying to figure out why it was that people overgrazed, overfished, overutilized resources. And what he ultimately came up with is that basically there was always going to be overexploitation of public resources when there was an opportunity for private gain at public cost or shared cost. So as long as we were dealing with some sort of shared resource that individuals could access for private gain, for private benefit, there would be some sort of overutilization of those resources. This applies, of course, to ranching, especially on public lands, commercial fishing. The Chesapeake Bay is a fabulous example of this. Heck, the fact that we all agree that we're not going to rob banks, certainly a great example. All right, so, you know, what does this have to do with plants? Okay, well, this is a form of game theory, where the strategy of an individual is impacted by the strategies of the other individuals that they're going to interact with. Okay, so, the beauty here is that we don't have to be dealing with humans. We can apply game theory to humans, we can apply game theory to vertebrates, we can apply game theory to plants. And that's because natural selection, of course, results in traits that appear to be logical. People often will use game theory to describe foraging behaviors of mammals. And it's not that we've got little gerbils sitting there doing calculus trying to figure out where they should be spending their time, right? This is not something that they're doing. Instead, those that actually happen to follow the behaviors as predicted by mathematical equations happen to receive greater benefits than those that don't. Same thing happens with plants. So these traits don't require organisms to think. Doesn't matter if they're humans or plants, okay? And so it turns out that, in fact, there's this fairly large body of theory that has been used quite frequently to describe human behavior, to describe animal behavior, but it hasn't really been used to describe, you might call it, the behavior of organisms that don't have brains, in spite of the fact that these organisms should, you know, behave fairly logically. All right, so I'm not going to throw the math at you. I'm just going to simplify this down to the basic predictions of the model. Okay, and what it comes down to, if you're interested in the math, we can talk about it afterwards. Okay, essentially, plants are going to favor growing their roots. This is below ground that we're interested in here, of course, in this session. That they're going to favor growing roots in unoccupied patches, places that no other plant is trying to grab resources. But this tends not to happen all that often. In natural environments, in agricultural systems, it just doesn't happen. So, in the absence of those kinds of patches, plants are going to favor growing roots in areas they don't already occupy, much the same way that a commercial fisherman is going to favor going and grabbing fish from areas that they're not currently pulling resources from. Okay? They're going to try to compete more with, oh, the fishermen from some other commercial company than with their own folks. Okay. So if we take this down to its simplest form, if we take a look at root growth, total root growth, not per plant, but total root growth, in a patch where we have multiple individuals that have access to it, and we compare that to a patch where only a single individual plant has access, okay, we would expect that the total roots, biomass, allocation, doesn't matter, okay, would be greater where the patch is shared than where it is exclusively occupied by a single individual. Now, this isn't the only idea out there. In fact, I've been involved in collecting data on some of the other ideas. There are a couple of other theories, and the predictions differ, fortunately, so it allows us to compare and contrast our results. Of course, one of the most obvious things plants, we hope, do is that they grow roots where there are resources. So essentially, we'd expect, hey, there's more resources here, there should be more roots there, right? Okay. Well, if we have, say, a pair of individuals competing, okay, and we double the amount of space and resources available, and we compare that to an individual plant in sort of half the space with half the resources, you know, the amount of resources and space per plant doesn't change, so we would expect roots, the total roots produced, to be the same regardless of whether or not there's competition, if that's the only factor. Okay? Competition avoidance has been studied fairly extensively now. It's potentially the result of allelopathy. It's potentially the result of all sorts of weird unknown mechanisms that people are still trying to figure out, but we find that there are plants that when they start growing their roots towards each other, we see root growth elongation rates slowing down and literally plants partitioning the soil volume. Okay? Of course, if they're slowing down root growth, this of course means that wherever there's competition, there's going to be fewer total roots than when there is no competition because they're trying to avoid each other. And then there's the predictions of the tragedy of the commons model where, of course, as I said, where there's competition, we expect there to be more roots than when there isn't. Now, pretty much none of these models really get into what you should expect in terms of reproductive tissue, but of course, if the amount of resources don't change, there are going to be ramifications for this extra root growth or this lack of root growth. Okay? So resource matching, pretty much if they're getting the same resource and they're growing the same roots regardless of whether or not there's a competitor present, we don't expect any impact on reproduction. Okay? With competition avoidance, you know, it's not entirely clear. So in some cases, it might actually be beneficial for these plants to be segregating their roots. In other cases, you know, maybe they're not then exploring the full root volume or soil volume, in which case we might expect competition to cause a decline in reproductive output. But in the tragedy of the commons, where there's this extra root production, there's more roots being produced, if we haven't changed the resources that are available to the plants, okay, that extra root production is using resources that could otherwise go to producing seed or other kinds of biomass. So we'd actually expect a decline in yield in plants that are competing compared to those that are not. Okay, so the very first test of this that we did was with soybeans. Okay? And we decided to see exactly, you know, first of all, was this response there and how robust was it? So we did a series of split root experiments where we essentially forced poor little soybeans to grow a whole bunch of extra root systems and become almost fibrous. And then we divided them up. So we had a series of experiments that we did in pots and some that we did in boxes. The boxes we used primarily because they helped us to kind of mimic the general spacing you might get in soybean fields. Okay? This was all done in a greenhouse setting. So we have on the left, let's see. We don't have a pointer, but do I have, there we go. Okay, so over here on the left, what you're seeing is essentially the two scenarios in which the plants are competing. Here, it's because they share the same volume in the open box area. Up here, it's because both plants have roots straddling both pots, so they both have roots in both pots. Over on this side, we have no competition, and this is basically where we have one plant per pot. They're right up against each other, so the above ground interactions are exactly the same. Okay, and this is not swapped. Sorry, for some reason, this didn't switch. So here we have the divider preventing them from interacting. So essentially here they're sharing place soil volume. Here it's exclusive access to pretty much half the space. So when we take a look at the biomass production of these plants, up at the top you can see seed production. Okay, on the left, okay, we have the areas where they were sharing the space. Okay. On the right, we have the spaces where they're divided from each other. And in both cases, there's a great deal more seed production, significantly so, when we separate these plants from each other. Okay. When we take a look at the roots, we see exactly the opposite pattern. We see a tremendous increase in the amount of roots being produced when they're sharing space compared to when they're not. And kind of interestingly, when we look at the above ground vegetative biomass, we don't see any effect. At least in these two studies. I just wanted to point out that, in fact, yes, as you get, even with all of these interesting things going on in terms of interactions, whenever you get a bigger plant, you get bigger roots, you get bigger shoots, you get bigger seeds. But if we tease these apart by treatment, you'll find that the effect of increased size is treatment dependent. So our solid lines here are our shared spaces. So on the x-axis, we've got root weight. So as roots increase, you see a little bit of an increase in seed mass. You see a little bit of an increase in shoot mass, okay, where we have them in competition compared to when they're in isolation, you see a tremendous increase in those same measurements. So as roots increase, let's see, where's my mouse? There it is. Here, where we have the plants separated, we see a much, much greater increase in seed mass and even in shoot mass. Okay? All right, so if we compare our data to our predictions, okay, well, in terms of roots, we got more roots when plants were competing compared to when they weren't. So that matches the tragedy of the commons prediction. And when we look at the reproductive tissue, we see the expected decline when the plants are competing. Okay? All right, so the theme of the talk is the tragedy of the commons in the field. Pots are nice, but they're really unrealistic, and that's something that people have often mentioned. Soil volume architecture, space could be affecting things. So we have this limited soil volume and depth. We have limited numbers of competitors that we can match up against each other. We have fairly limited spacing in terms of how far apart we can put our plants. And of course, resources behave differently. In all of our pot and our box experiments, we use things like vermiculite and sand, combinations of those things, and fed our plants hydroponically just to try and minimize the variation in resource distribution in those pots. But of course, that's not realistic. So we wanted to take this to a slightly more realistic situation where we had maybe not native undisturbed soil, but something that becomes a much closer approximation to this. Again, this does in an agricultural setting, of course, not take into account the effects of tillage and the addition of fertilizers and other chemical treatments, but we're getting a little bit more realistic here. So we actually bribed some poor man with a backhoe to come to the middle of downtown Chicago and dig a giant ditch for us. This ditch was 1.2 meters by 7 meters, and it was about half a meter deep. And this is because we were working with Williams variety, and the majority of the roots of Williams variety is pretty much in the A horizon, which in northern Illinois is about half a meter deep. So we didn't want to really go much deeper than that, even though, yes, there are occasionally roots that go that deep. So we then planted them in there so that way they were about 10 centimeters apart from each other within a row, and the rows were 40 centimeters apart, which is fairly standard practice for growing soybeans, at least in this area. Okay? We had three different treatments within this giant ditch. We had compartments where we had just a single group of plants. Okay? We had sections where we had two groups of plants, and then we had an open section. And yes, this is technically pseudo-replication for this giant open section, but you try and get somebody with a backhoe to dig you a bigger hole. We'll do more, I promise. All right, so the predictions of the model are kind of interesting because, of course, with each of our compartments, we have increasing numbers of competitors. And what you see here is that we have, two different lines here. Here's our cost. Our cost is increasing for an individual plant, okay, pretty much as it produces more roots. Okay, those roots cost more. Okay, now the benefit, okay, is of course going to decline as the number of competitors increases. As the more plants that are there that are fighting over the available resources, as it increases, the less resource there is for an individual. So in fact, what we would expect is that the fewer competitors, we would expect less roots. So the more competitors on this line here, we're dealing with two competitors. On this line, we're actually dealing with 10 competitors. So you can see that the total amount of roots that would be predicted is going up. All right, so again, this field design, we have our three competitors, we have our six competitors, and here we actually have 20 rows, so 60 competitors. All right, so what we would expect in terms of shoot biomass, based on our greenhouse experiments, we wouldn't expect any difference in our shoot biomass, regardless of which compartment the plants are found in. In terms of the seed and pod biomass, we would expect those individual rows, those sets of three plants, to produce more biomass than the two rows, and those would produce more biomass than the open area, the commons. And of course, we would expect exactly the reverse with our root biomass. Okay. Here's our above ground vegetative biomass. We could not get at the roots because, of course, this was soil with dividers. Okay? But our vegetative biomass, you see, there really isn't there's no significant effect of treatment. So separating these plants didn't do anything to them. But when we look at reproductive tissue, we see a very different story. Okay? So here we have numbers and here we have masses. And you'll notice in each case, those individual groups of three plants are producing significantly more biomass than the other compartments. So they're producing more than the groups of six plants, and they're producing more than the group of 60 plants. Okay? So we see a dramatic change in the biomass production. Now, if we sort of look at this in great detail, there is a difference in seed size, and there's a difference in pod number. So that's where the primary differences are coming from. The plants that have fewer competitors are producing more pods, and those pods have bigger seeds in them. So, as we look at the field, okay, again, the tragedy of the commons predictions seem to be supported in this slightly more realistic setting. And again, the reproductive tissue outcome matches what we've seen in the greenhouse setting. So, it looks like the tragedy of the commons pretty much happens in soybeans no matter what we do to them. We've grown them in the absence of nitrogen, we've grown them at really high nutrient levels, we've grown them at low nutrient levels, and we see this increase in root production no matter what. Okay. In pots in our experiment, we typically see about a 20 to 33% increase in yield when we separate those plants. In the field, that was about a 30% increase in yield that we saw. Of course, this is a very small plot. It's a very small study. These are preliminary results. But these preliminary results are really strongly supportive of this idea that the tragedy of the commons might really be going on in our agricultural fields, at least with soybeans. So, plants do display the tragedy of the commons. I want to point out that they don't always do this, and this is a really key thing here, because I'm not proposing that folks go out and put a whole bunch of plastic dividers in their fields. That would be difficult, to say the least, probably cost prohibitive. But there are plants that don't do this, and there are situations when some plants that do this stop. We've looked at several annual wild plants, things like black-eyed Susan, for example. If you provide a lot of resources to the black-eyed Susans, this tragedy of the commons response disappears. Okay? So we can affect it. We can't seem to affect it in soybeans, but the fact that other plants can stop doing this gives us an indication that there's definitely potential for selecting or some sort of gene manipulation in the soybeans to prevent this from happening to increase our yields. Okay? What's fascinating is that, in fact, yes, we can get rid of this in native plants, non-domesticated plants. So, of course, it raises the question, gee, have we bred this into our crops by growing fields and selecting against those individuals in a giant field that are all experiencing competition that don't produce many seeds? Because, of course, that's what an individual would do if they don't engage in the tragedy of the commons in a field of others that are. Okay? And what's kind of fun here is that if we compare the results of just putting in these dividers to what people have done before, it really drives home the importance of cost-benefit analysis in root biomass allocation. You know, between the mid-1930s and 1992, the yield increase in soybeans was about 29%. Okay? That's what we were able to do with crop breeding, with selective breeding. Just by putting in these dividers, we've pretty much matched that in one season. So this is a pretty significant increase in yield that, you know, I hope some people are able to pay some, you know, some attention to when it comes to breeding for specific root traits. All right, thank you very much. With the same seeds, no. We have done it a second time in the same plot. We excavated it out again and put the dividers in, and the results were very similar.
So you have done 2 years?
We've done 2 years, that's it, yeah. What I would really like to do is actually a much larger plot, to have many more plants. These we grew, you know, we tried to mimic what the cultivation techniques were in the area. So this was done in Chicago, so we used basically Northern Illinois soybean farming practices as our standard. And the year we did this was actually a pretty decent year for growth. We had pretty good rainfall, so we really didn't have to supplement it with water. People were largely not doing a lot of irrigation. But I think that, you know, this sample size is so small that we do definitely need larger numbers. Yes?
How about your definers just change your roof architecture and force roofs to go deep, and that is a good ideal type, as Jonathan Lynch proposed in the future?
I think that's true. That would be fabulous, and I think that that's something that might be a solution to some of these problems, because we've actually made the model as I presented it. Well, you didn't get to see the math, but it's actually spatially implicit, but we have made it explicit. And the big thing here is pretty much how far is a plant going to spread its roots laterally in the absence of any kind of competition, any kind of neighbors. You know, that pretty much tells you, if you get two of those areas, you figure out how far a plant is going to grow its roots, and you put neighbors so that those sort of ideal root spreads are going to overlap. You're going to have plants experiencing the tragedy of the commons wherever they're going to be overlapping. So if you can narrow that lateral spread, you pretty much can minimize how much of this is going to happen. Do I think that there could be a change in root architecture? Well, there is a change in root production. Whether there is a change in primary roots, lateral roots, and that's affecting things, we don't know. We haven't looked at the actual root structures. That's true. So it could be a change in that. It does not have to be a biomass change. It's any form of change of investment. If the investment it results in more resources being allocated to those roots, there's less left for reproduction. Am I missing your question? It looks like it.
No, not completely.
Okay.
It's all right.
Yes.
Just to be clear,
yes.
You're saying that the resources are constant, the soil, nutrients, water is constant. If you let them compete versus you divide the space mm-hmm. and resources to each plant separately, mm-hmm. you get higher yield.
Yes.
Correct.
Yes, so that the
less root biomass.
You get less. You get considerably less root biomass when you divide them. So if you keep the space and the amount of resources per plant constant, and the only thing you change is you put a divider between them so that they can't interact, yeah, that you get a decline in seed or a decline in root.
This is true of whether it's a shallow-rooted plant or a deep.
It varies from plant to plant. We've done this with a variety of legumes. So Kenya beans, this works. Peas, this works quite well. Depending on the conditions, there are a number of non-agricultural species for which this works quite well. We have not done this with a perennial. And the big problem there is that, of course, as soon as you get into perennials, basically you're talking about an iterated game. And in game theory, as soon as you have the opportunity to potentially have long-term ramifications for behaviors or for growth changes, the strategies become different.
So this implies that if on a corn, for example, if you plant them in rows, you tend to separate them more than if you don't plant them in rows, just broadcast them.
Right,
so
right.
So you get a better yield with the rows.
Sure. Sure. As long as row spacing minimizes overlap.
Even if the plant population is the same.
Right.
It's similar to skip row planting, I guess, for corn in the Great Plains. In the corn in the Great Plains, it's a skip row planting where you skip a row mm-hmm.
right.
to maximize water availability.
Right. Well, and it's also, I mean, it's, you know, chances are it's one of the good reasons why, if these plants are doing it, why these mixed cultures, intercropping may be helpful. It's not only is it kind of, do you have plants next to each other that are maybe not competing in exactly the same part of the soil volume, but at the same time, you know, they don't have that extra added on stress of fighting with each other with this increase in root production.
Different species.
Right. Different species or different varieties.
And that could change the situation.
It could, very much so, yes. As soon as this situation, the reason why this is kind of interesting is because we dealt with a monoculture. So these are plants that are all doing exactly the same thing, exactly the same way, for the most part. If you start dealing with different kinds of varieties, or if you end up with a situation just where you put in one plant earlier, you give one plant an advantage, and you make the interaction asymmetric, it changes things dramatically. And that's when you tend to see much more in the way of resource matching, when you have some sort of asymmetry going on.
It's sort of like Jonathan's suggestion of having those plants with different phenological characteristics
right.
mixed in together.
Exactly.
One more question. Yes.
Sorry. It was hard that domestication may have resulted in this. Have you tested a wild soybean?
We really want to. We have not done that yet, but that is definitely on the list of things to do. Yeah. Yeah, in fact, there are a number of wild versus domesticated cultivars that we want to compare and see, you know, if the tragedy of the commons occurs in the domesticated, if whether or not it occurs in the wild type.
Yeah. We'll take your question. You had your hand up before.
Okay. Well, this is based on an evolutionary perspective, right? So then it would be kind of counterintuitive that artificial selection would actually induce this evolutionary thing. Yeah. And also, often in breeding programs, they plant the same variety together. Mm-hmm. So if they were expressing a lack of the tragedy of the commons, then they would be with other people that aren't cheaters.
Right. So what this is, it's an evolutionary stable strategy. And the problem is that, of course, these are plants that if they diverge at all in a population where every individual is doing exactly the same thing, if they diverge from this at all, then they suffer. They show a decrease in yield. So yeah, when you try and select for traits and you're doing it on a field level, okay, you're basically going, hey, this is a plant that's not producing as much. Well, it may be very well because it's not doing the tragedy.
Plants together, same
exactly, phenotype. Exactly.
So what I'm saying though is that the non-cheaters would be planted together; they would have higher yield.
It would well, possibly yes.
Usually they don't plant like a mixed. Maybe in early agriculture, it's all mixed
right.
together.
So if you had a group that had exact, and you could be guaranteed that it had exactly the same genotype, certainly.
Okay. Yeah. One other part of the seed yield decreases when you let them compete.
Right.
What about above ground shoot biomass?
It can be affected in soybeans. We haven't really seen much of an effect. So in soybeans, the above ground vegetative biomass does not seem to be affected. In other species, it has been affected because, of course, like I said, the models don't actually predict where these resources are going to be drawn from. Are they going to be, you know, are they going to affect seed production? Are they going to affect leaf production, support tissue production? You know, that's not part of the model. We just know it has to come from someplace. So in some plants, we definitely might expect an effect on above ground vegetative biomass.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
It was very interesting.